Three pieces of labor legislation are scheduled to come before the next session of Congress. Now in committee, they are the Davis-Bacon Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and the Fair Labor Standards Act. Amendments are being considered for each of these bills, and here to explain the impact of those amendments is Dr. Kenneth Kovach, a professor of management at George Mason University. Dr. Kovach has published four books and numerous articles in the area of personnel and labor relations. Dr. Kovach, welcome to Frankly Speaking.
Thank you, Penny.
Tell us who is likely to be affected by a change in each of these bills.
The Davis-Bacon Act will affect most directly contractors with federal construction projects. That includes both union and non-union contractors. Indirectly, it'll affect all taxpayers because it's estimated that you could cut the inflation rate by anywhere from 3/4 to 1.5%, depending on who you believe, if certain amendments are made to Davis-Bacon, and that would affect everybody's tax rate. So indirectly, everybody's affected.
How about fair labor?
Fair Labor Standards Act would affect all those employees who work for an employer who's required to pay overtime. It would change the amount of overtime or the number of hours necessary to kick in overtime. So it affects everyone who works overtime over 40 in a 168-hour period.
And how about the National Labor Relations?
The National Labor Relations Act will directly affect all union employees, about 22 million people. Indirectly, it will affect all employees in industries that are heavily unionized, but that employee is not working for a union firm.
Okay, let's take a look at them one at a time. Can you tell us what is the Davis-Bacon Act and how it's being proposed to be amended?
Okay, the Davis-Bacon Act was originally passed by the federal government in 1931 to protect themselves against what they felt was some shoddy craftsmanship on federal construction projects. Those projects were and are led on competitive bid, lowest competitive bidder. At that time, with 24.9% unemployment, a lot of contractors were getting unqualified or underqualified workers. Being able to pay them less because they weren't qualified, and coming in with a lower bid, since your direct labor costs were at that time 60 to 65% of your total costs. Well, these contractors were getting the contracts, and the government was getting things built nice and cheap, but the quality left a lot to be desired. Hence, they passed what's called the Prevailing Wage Act, or Davis-Bacon Act, to protect themselves, which simply says, in a nutshell, contractors or subcontractors on federal construction projects must pay the prevailing wage for the locality.
Explain again prevailing wage for us.
Okay. The Labor Department was tasked and is with administering this thing. So they have to define what the locality is and what the prevailing wage is. Locality it's caused some trouble, but the big trouble has been defining what is prevailing wage. The law doesn't give them any guidance on that. So way back in the 30s, the Labor Department came up with a system to define prevailing wage. Once they've set the locality, which is determined by how big the contractor and project is, then they run a wage survey of all the workers in that locality on construction projects, trade by trade, plumbers, carpenters, and so on. So if you can envision a big board with all these rates of pay on it, they then look at them and say, okay, what is the most common rate of pay to the penny, including wages and fringe benefits, that's being paid in this locality for that trade? That rate then becomes the, quote, prevailing wage that all contractors on federal construction projects must pay in that locality.
All right. That's caused some problem, though.
Yes, it's caused a lot of problems. It's caused 52 years of problems. If our listeners can envision this big board with all the numbers, if you're looking for a rate of pay, wages and fringes, to the penny that's more common than any other, it's pretty obvious that all the non-union rates of pay are going to have some dissimilarities in them, because they're not governed by a standard contract, whereas the union rates of pay are all going to be to the penny the same. Hence, what's happened is prevailing wage has in effect become union wage. And there's the rub. That forces all non-union contractors, who today account for almost 70% of federal construction, to pay union wage.
Clearly, then, the unions don't want to change in this act.
Right. One of President Reagan's campaign promises was that he would not repeal the Davis-Bacon Act, and he's kept that promise. He has, however, sought to amend the Davis-Bacon Act, and the only reason it hasn't been amended or outright repealed, in my opinion so far, has been the pressure that's been brought by the AFL-CIO's Building Construction Trades Division. They are very much against it. Think about what the impact is for them. If we stop defining prevailing wage as union wage, then we reintroduce wage costs, which still are over half of your direct costs, as a factor in this competitive bidding. And with union firms having to pay higher wages, they're no longer going to be the lowest bidder. Hence, they lose all their federal construction projects. So we can understand why they fought tooth and nail for years to stop the amendment or the outright repeal of Davis-Bacon.
What would you like to see happen with this?
I'd like to see, well, personally, I'd like to see the thing repealed, but being a pragmatist, I think that the best we can hope for at this point is that some amendment is made to the definition of prevailing wage so that it doesn't automatically become union wage. If we could somehow say, well, you have to have at least 10% or 30% of the people receiving that wage, then in an area that's predominantly non-union, you wouldn't have the union wage governing. Because after all, if you think about it, if I'm a non-union contractor and I get a contract from the federal government, I have to pay my people whatever the going wage is on that project. Well, Thursday they're working on a non-federal project and they get $6 an hour. But Friday when they go to the federal project, they have to be paid $10.50 an hour because that's union wage. These are the same people. And Monday they'll be back at $6 an hour on a non-federal project. They're no more skilled. It hasn't increased the quality of the construction. It hasn't changed the people. It's ridiculous. And it contributes to inflation. It costs the government a lot of money. And it hits us all in the pocketbook at tax time.
Let's go to the Fair Labor Standards Act. What percentage of the workforce is affected by this act?
Well, if you're talking directly affected, probably about 25 to 30% of the workforce. Only those people who are subject to the provisions of Fair Labor Standards Act through their employers, i.e. those who have to be paid time and a half over 40 hours,
okay.
Which of course excludes your salaried and professional.
Right. This is an act that affects overtime pay, minimum hours, and minimum wage.
Right.
What are the amendments that are being proposed for
okay.
it?
The amendments that are being proposed, and they, by the way, have about a 50-50 chance of being passed in the next session of Congress, primarily center around the overtime provisions. Back in 1938, when this act was passed under the Roosevelt administration, you again had high unemployment until the war. Yet the average work week was 46 to 48 hours for the people who were employed. President Roosevelt wanted to spread this out. So he said, we're going to dictate 40 hours, eight-hour days, as the standard work day. Now that we didn't tell anybody, or they didn't tell anybody, you couldn't work more than that. But what they said to the employers was, if you work your people more than 40 hours in a week, you have to pay them time and a half. So the employer at that time, who had 500 people all working 48 hours a week, everybody worked Saturday, realized this was economically foolish. What I should do is hire more people so that they all work 40 hours a week. I get the same total number of man hours for my labor force, and I save on my labor costs because nobody gets time and a half. And that was the whole intent, was to spread the employment out, to encourage employers to hire more people. Now, with unemployment running high for the last few years, there's been a revision of this school of thought, and that's the basis for the amendment in Congress now, which has widespread bipartisan support. To make it double time over 40.
The idea is to encourage employment by making it costly to have workers work overtime.
Right. It was a good idea in 1938, and of course it didn't wipe out unemployment, but it certainly was a step in the right direction. But what's happened since then is the fringe benefit package, the economic supplements, have become so expensive. Back in 1938, they accounted for about 5% of total labor costs. We're talking about paid vacations, paid holidays, pensions, insurance. So the employer was faced with a decision of hiring more people, working them all 40 hours, and incurring the extra 5% fringe benefits that it cost to hire them. Well, that wasn't very much. But today, these fringe benefits total about 40% in the private sector of total labor costs. So the employer has, the break-even point has been pushed further away. It's no longer economically to my advantage to hire these new workers because I've got to pick up all the fringe benefits. It makes more sense to pay the time and a half for the present workers and forego the increased fringe benefits for new workers. It's a fixed cost spread over more units. So as fringe benefits have increased because of tax laws and so on, the effect of the Fair Labor Standards Act overtime provision has been minimized.
If we change that, if we make an amendment in this act, what will be the effect on the employer?
Okay. The employer will then be faced with a decision, just like they were in 1938. If we make it double time, you see what happens. We've brought the break-even point back again. And the employer now finds it economically feasible to hire more workers at an earlier time with less overtime. So what happens to the employer is nothing, really, except they increase their labor force, get the same number of hours spread over more employees, and hopefully it helps unemployment. It certainly won't wipe it out, but it will help.
One of the side effects of the Fair Labor Standards Act seems to be promotion of a decent living standard. as it is the act accomplishing that?
Well, that's a political hot potato. It depends on which side of the aisle you speak with. My personal opinion is yes, $3.35, which is the present minimum wage, is adequate for what I would consider a reasonable living standard, but I'm sure that's a value judgment. I wouldn't impose my values on anyone else.
Will the amendment increase the minimum wage?
No, that's not the thrust of the amendment. The amendment is solely aimed at the overtime provisions.
Okay, let's take a look at the National Labor Relations Act. What is it?
Okay. Passed in 1935, commonly known as the Wagner Act after the senator from New York, it is the basic piece of labor legislation we have in this country. It and its amendments are the law of the land as far as how employers and unions interrelate with each other. And one of the criticisms, I picked on organized labor in the Davis-Bacon Act. I want to alienate everyone I can. Management, if I can pick on them this time, has been, through the widespread use of high-paid labor consultants and labor avoidance experts, as they call themselves, subverting the intent of the National Labor Relations Act. The basic problem is that the penalties imposed for violation of the National Labor Relations Act are not enough to deter the crime. If an employer can commit what are known as unfair labor practices to keep a union out or to stall the signing of a union contract, even for a couple weeks or a couple months, in some cases a couple years, the severest, we can see the labor savings that they generate from that. The severest penalty that the National Labor Relations Board, the agency that administers the act, can apply is a $10,000 fine for, quote, willful and repeated offenses. Well, a $10,000 fine to a big company, if they can keep a union out for a year, for 2 months, for a week, if you think of their labor savings, it's more than worth it. So you've got a number of big employers who are willfully violating the law with impunity, knowing they're going to be caught, knowing that the fine is a drop in the bucket compared to their savings, and that's the problem. And so unions have been pushing, and their friends, very hard to get an amendment to the National Labor Relations Act to, in effect, increase a variety of penalties to take the economic feasibility out of violating the act.
What are some of the amendments, just briefly?
Well, briefly, the back pay that a person's awarded if they have been the subject of a ULP increased to double time as opposed to straight time. The biggest single amendment, in my opinion, there's seven or eight amendments, the biggest single amendment is giving the National Labor Relations Board the power to pull federal contracts from employers who are found to willfully and repeatedly violate the act. The small employer, it isn't economically feasible to do this. It's the big ones that are the trouble. And if you pull the federal contracts from some of those big employers, people like J.P. Stevens and Phelps Dodge, people like that, then you're going to get their attention. Well, of course, that amendment's been fought tooth and nail by National Association of Manufacturers, a number of management groups. So they're the rub in that one, I think.
This was proposed by Carter back in 78?
Yes, it was originally proposed by President Carter. As a matter of fact, President Carter said he would sign it. It got through the House. It got within one vote of passage in the Senate. You need two-thirds to amend this thing. Within one vote, literally, and was defeated. It's now been resurrected under a new name. It's been toned down a little, but it's basically the same thrust. Whether it will be passed or not in this Congress remains to be seen.
If some of these amendments are passed, how long does it take before they're implemented?
Well, if you're talking about things like the National Labor Relations Act, our last one, it's going to take the better part of a year because the NLRB doesn't move with a lot of speed on a lot of these things. It takes time for these cases to work their way up through the system.
Today on Frankly Speaking, we've been discussing labor reform bills now pending in Congress. My guest has been Dr. Kenneth Kovach, Professor of Management at George Mason University. If you have questions about our program or our guests, please call 323-2138. I'm Penny Goodman, and my technician today has been Michelle Lassane Montgomery. Thank you for listening.